Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
We are a couple of weeks removed since Nike announced former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick was the focus of the latest ad campaign. The former San Francisco 49ers star has faced backlash and praise alike over the last couple of years for taking a knee during pre-match renditions of the American national anthem in protest against police brutality. One man who's pretty well qualified to discuss this story is former United States Army Green Beret and NFL player Nate Boyer, who advised Kaepernick on the best way to protest while also trying to show respect to the military at the same time. And Nate Boyer joins me on the line now. Nate, you're very welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
First of all, you have a football background of your own and a pretty unusual one. You're a walk-on down in Texas.
Yeah, so, you know, growing up, I grew up a huge 49ers fan, first of all, the team Kaepernick played for. And I loved the sport. It was my favorite sport. I played every other one you can imagine, and football just never quite worked out. I remember being 14 years old and thinking I was already too old to get started, so I didn't do it. Fast forward 15 more years after 6 years in the Army as a Green Beret, I went to college at the University of Texas and decided to try out for the football team just to kind of see what would happen. You know, it was like a regret that I had, and I ended up making the team. And by my sophomore year, I'd found a place on the field as a, you know, starting long snapper, and eventually had an opportunity with the Seattle Seahawks through all that. So it was a pretty different story and a kind of a sideways direction into football, but it worked out great. You know, I was happy to have the opportunity.
It's one of these things I've often heard about, is the players who come to it quite late and players who are, I'm not going to say you're smaller in stature, but you're what, about 5'10", is it, I believe, in height in around that kind of country?
For a football player, I'm dinky.
Yeah. But you often hear about the smaller players, and particularly ones who kind of maybe come to it late in college or who are kind of late appointments to the squad or to the roster, that they actually have this drive and determination behind them that makes them want to try harder on the pitch and kind of show their worth. And I think that was very much the case with yourself in Texas.
Yeah, you know, my dad made that exact point to me. He said, I don't think if you had played when you were younger, he's like, I don't think you ever would have done this. Because first of all, you wouldn't have felt like you kind of missed out on something. But also, you probably would have realized how difficult it is, you know. But I had that naivety of not playing. And you know, not to mention, I mean, I was in pretty good shape. And I had this confidence after serving in the military that I could go out there and I could just work harder than everybody and find a way. Which ended up being true, but I don't know if I would have believed in myself or believed that if I had played before.
How did the Seahawks opportunity arise?
Well, I played at Texas. I was a starter for 3 years for the Longhorns, and you know, I was 33 my senior season, and pretty much figured that was going to be the end of my career football-wise. And I played in this senior all-star game out in Charleston, South Carolina, called the Medal of Honor Bowl. They have about four senior all-star games for college players every year. And this was one of the smaller ones. You know, there's two kind of big ones, and then there's two smaller ones. And even those, though, they have all these NFL scouts that come to the practices throughout the week and just evaluate players and sit down with them and meet with them. And, you know, I didn't think – I was – 5'10", 195 pounds at the time. I didn't think any of them would meet with me, or at least take me seriously, especially being 33 and coming to the game so late. I didn't long snap my first football till I was 31. And sure enough, I had four different teams sit down with me and interview me and kind of, you know, tell me like, look, you're going to have to put on about 30 pounds, but you know, you should give it a shot because you're a good snapper. And so I started gaining the weight, and lifting crazy amounts, eating crazy amounts, and over the course of 4 months, you know, I put on about I think 35 pounds. So I got pretty, you know, I got up there, and sure enough, on the last day of the draft, I think it was actually I believe it was May 2nd of definitely 2015, but it was the biggest day in sports history, at least in American sports history. They had a Floyd Mayweather was boxing Manny Pacquiao. It was also the same day as the Kentucky Derby. And then there was like three or four game sevens in both hockey and the NBA for basketball during the playoffs. And so it was all these things going on. And then sure enough, also on the last day of the draft, I had this opportunity to sign with the Seattle Seahawks. I had to choose between, it was then the St. Louis Rams, who now play in Los Angeles, and the Seahawks. And the reason I went with Seattle is because they'd been to back-to-back Super Bowls. They'd won one of them. And I just thought it was, you know, a bigger challenge to go there. I didn't want to regret not going as big as I possibly could. And, you know, it was a great experience, even though I only played in one game.
How did your military service inform your football career? Because as you mentioned, like, you're a 33-year-old senior. You're obviously going to be a deal older than those surrounding you down in Texas. And again, being drafted, you're going to be one of the older members of the draft there. But you had this incredible background behind you as well, where you'd obviously served in the U.S. military as a Green Beret. Does that give you a certain air of gravitas in the dressing room? Did people treat you slightly differently than those around you when you're involved in football directly?
I think it does. It does from the other players in the locker room, but it definitely, you know, it doesn't necessarily. You don't just get preferential treatment, you know, and you're not just going to play because of your background. Like, that doesn't, the best player plays, period. The one who's most suitable for that position. And that's why for me, it ultimately didn't work out in the NFL. You know, I didn't get through I played in the preseason, but I didn't make the final roster because I wasn't the best. And that's fine. I mean, that's the way it should be. Mm. You should always be the best man for the job, just like it's the best man or woman for any job in society. Regardless of background and any other characteristics, you know, I was totally okay with that. But I definitely, especially in college, I mean, every year you've got 18 and 19 year old freshmen coming in, you know, and there's this old creepy guy in the locker room who's, you know, telling stories to, or not really me. I'd have other players on the team tell the stories for me. You know, they'd tell some ridiculous war stories to these kids, and they believed every bit of it. And it was kind of fun to have that sort of relationship with these guys that were by and large 10 years younger than me. But at the same time, like, I felt just as connected to the game and to them as any other player. I mean, I don't think guys really mature much past 19 anyway. I mean, we know that.
Just a little bit, yeah.
So yeah, it worked out. And you know, I had to work just as hard as every one of them to earn a spot on the field. And I had to find a thankless job, which was long snapping, something that nobody loves to do because it's, you know, you can do it 500 times in a row, great. And the one time you screw up, you're the bad guy.
Yeah, too right. When it came around to the start of the 2016 season, then you would have been forgiven for maybe, I suppose, not paying that much attention to what was going on in preseason. But ultimately, one of the bigger stories in the NFL kind of came to pass during that period when we saw Colin Kaepernick's first protests against police brutality in the US. What were your initial responses? Because I know that ultimately prompted you to write a letter to Army Times, or were you approached to write the letter to Army Times? Give us a kind of timeline on that.
Yeah, I didn't even understand where it was coming from at first. I mean, granted, we're in the middle of the presidential election at that time. You know, 2 months later, we would all be voting. Hillary or Donald. You know, it was the Trump-Clinton election, and we were very divided already. We've been kind of pulled apart at the seams over the years leading up to that. And it was just, everything just seemed so binary. You had to pick, you know, left or right, blue or red. Are you with this team or that team? And you got to spend all your time proving why your team is right, why your side is right, and why everybody else is wrong. And everyone's digging in and not listening and not being respectful, and social media is not helping. Mainstream media is not helping. It's just, and it's still like that, you know, but it was kind of really coming to a head at that time. And then boom, Colin Kaepernick sitting on the bench during the anthem because he says he doesn't want to stand for the flag of a country that oppresses black people and people of color. And I took offense to that, as many did, because those symbols do not stand for that to me and to also many people across the world, in the developing world specifically. I mean, that flag is a symbol of hope. You know, it's this idea that you can come to a place and have opportunities, you know. And yes, things aren't perfect, and no, things are not completely equal. Like, we still have a long way to go. But as compared to other places, that the type of oppression here is very different than the oppression that I was around in Afghanistan and Iraq and Sudan. So I did take offense. It did hurt to see that because I fought for what those colors represent as well. But at the same time, I had to understand that that's my experience. That's only my experience. And I can't judge somebody or assume anybody else's experience and what those things may mean to them. That's just as ignorant as somebody saying, you know, they know what it's like to strap on the combat boots and go to war. I don't know what it's like to grow up as a person of color in this country. And so I approached it instead with a little bit of an open mind and respect. And I decided to, I'd been reached out to by a few publications to write like an op-ed. And I didn't want to give my opinion because I don't think that was helping anything. I said, I don't want to just give you my opinion of what he should do or why he's wrong or whatever. Mm. Instead, I'll just write this open letter explaining my experiences, but also letting him understand and know that I'm willing to listen to his and to be respectful. And the letter went viral, I think, because I would say 70 to 80% of our country is very reasonable and kind of in the middle on things, but we don't ever hear those voices. So for the first time, we're hearing a voice from, you know, what I call the radical middle. And people are like, yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I don't agree with everything, but that's his right. It elicited, you know, quite a response from even the media world, but also Colin himself, you know, ended up reaching out. And the next day I met him down in San Diego. He wanted to sit down with me and ask me some questions and kind of talk about things. We ended up having a face-to-face 2-hour meeting on game day before they were playing the Chargers. And it was that night through our conversation that he decided to take a knee alongside his teammates instead of sitting on the bench.
Was there any reluctance on your part to go meet him? Were you a little bit like thinking, oh, Christ, what more can I say in person to this guy that I haven't already said in this letter? Or were you keen as to get down there and actually speak with him face to face?
I was interested to speak with him because I thought it was good for our country to see those type of conversations. But I was also hesitant because I was worried I would be taken advantage of, you know what I mean? Or used as a
photo,
you know,
opportunity.
A publicity stunt, you know, and I didn't want to be a part of that. And I've still had bouts with that over the last 2 years where I felt like it was a little bit of that because of a lack of response at times from, you know, from his camp during this whole process. But hey, you know, I think it was still a powerful moment and something that people need to see more of. I wish he would engage in more of those situations and conversations. He hasn't done an interview at least a candid interview in the last, you know, 2+ years. And he definitely hasn't, as far at least in a public forum, sat down with people that don't necessarily see eye to eye with him and just have a conversation. We need to see more of that. And he could be a very unifying force in our country. I really believe that because of how much of a pop icon he is at this point. But, that is his decision, so it's tough.
2 hours is a long time to spend directly in conversation with somebody you've never met before, even if there is a fairly big discussion to have in and around a specific moment or a specific action. Like, what kind of person did you find in Colin Kaepernick when you sat down for those 2 hours?
He was very sensitive and was a good listener, you know, and really cared about my perspective and, kind of asked after the conversation, is there another way you think I can demonstrate that'll still be powerful? You know, that'll still bring this type of attention that won't hurt people like you and people, in the military, you know? And I said, cause he said, I'm not going to stand regardless. I will not stand until changes are made. And I asked, you know, I asked specifically what changes, I mean, what are your measurable goals? Because you need to have those. And at that time, he did not have them. Mm. But it was very early on, and I think it blew up a lot bigger than he thought it would. It was through that I suggested kneeling because it was, you know, it's never been considered a sign of disrespect in our history that I can think of. I mean, it's always been respectful. I mean, we take a knee. You kneel in front of the king or queen. Mm. When someone gets knighted, they kneel. When someone proposed to their wife, or they pray, or a player's hurt on the field, everyone takes a knee out of respect. It's like always been seen as this respectful gesture. So I thought that was more powerful. I thought being alongside his teammates was important too, instead of sitting on the bench isolated.
While we talk here, there's images of yourself standing alongside Kaepernick on the sideline there, and while he takes a knee, you're standing alongside him and saluting the anthem. I'm just interested in something you had to say there, that you're surprised that he hasn't really spoken publicly since. Like, obviously, perhaps he might point towards an ongoing court case that one surrounding collusion and whether or not he's been blackballed by the NFL and by NFL sides. But as you say, beyond a Nike ad and beyond sound bites, it seems as if further conversation with him, I don't know who that might be with, might be helpful. Have you kept in contact with him since? Have there been attempts on your part to reach out to him, on his part to reach out to you? How have the last 2 years gone down between the two of you?
Yeah, we spoke throughout the rest of that season. So really all of 2016 and 17, a football season. And we really haven't spoke since, you know, and I have reached out, through his team, through his camp or whatever you want to call it. And I've gotten responses that, yes, Colin, you know, really, really looks up to you and respects you. And he talks about you all the time, all this stuff. But I haven't talked to him personally in quite a long time. And then communication seems to just fizzle every time that happens.
I get it, man.
I mean, he's an icon right now. I mean, he's this big. He's receiving awards all over the world for different things. You know, from Amnesty International and Sports Person of the Year and obviously this big Nike campaign and all that. So, I mean, it makes sense, but it's still a little frustrating. I'm not gonna lie, because I feel like I was an important part of this whole story.
Do you feel a little bit used by it all?
I don't feel used by it. I just feel forgotten. Okay. And that's just, it is what it is.
If he was to speak, and if he was to sit down with an interviewer, and it's like the way the media is especially so fragmented in the US now, and it's like you say, either left or right and so polarized on one side or the other, like, what would you like to hear from him?
From him?
Yeah.
I would like for him to, for instance, sit down with people in the criminal justice system, police officers, and let everybody understand that maybe even that he had done and said some things in the past that, I don't want to say regrets, but would change, like the voting thing. The number one way in our country that you could be a part of change is voting, and everybody has a vote. If you're 18 years of age, and you've got your legal voting status or whatever, you have just as much of a say as anybody. And for him to say, "I'm not going to vote for an oppressive country," when we had a racist country, even when we had an African American man in office at that time, Barack Obama as the president. Is frustrating, you know what I mean? And people on the right, they stick to that stuff. They harp on that stuff. They don't think about anything else except for that, the socks that he wore with police officers dressed, as pigs dressed as police officers, or the Fidel Castro shirts or the Malcolm X hats or all these things. Like, that's all people on the right will harp on and focus on. They won't listen to his message because of those things. And he, hasn't addressed. I think it's important to address those things, and then to sit down with people that are on completely opposite ends of the spectrum as him, to explain why and where and what his experiences is, and why he's doing what he's doing. Because the more we have conversations with those that we don't see to eye with and don't understand, we come to this place where we realize, okay, I don't necessarily agree still with why you're doing what you're doing, but I understand where it's coming from, and I can empathize with that at least. And it's hard for people to empathize if they don't understand where he's coming from, if they don't really hearing it from him. And that's something important that I wish he would do for the sake of our country for the sake of all those people in the middle. Because there's going to be a certain percentage of people on the far left and far right that you're never going to change. And that's just, it is what it is. I mean, they're going to be so extreme that there's just no point in fighting that battle. But there's a lot of us in the middle who feel divided. And I think that there's an opportunity to unify us. And I think he should be one of those people leading that charge.
Yeah, it could be a really interesting 2 years ahead, not just for Colin Kaepernick, but also your country as well. Nate Boyer, we wish you the very best. Thanks so much for speaking to us today.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.